Welcome to Unmasking the Feminine. I'm Rachel Talbot. And my guest today is Stephanie Fabella, who I've known sort of a little bit for quite a few years, and we share a lot of common interests. And I'm really excited to share her story. Stephanie works as an intimacy coach. And when you hear where she came from, you will be amazed that she chose that as her profession. And she's incredibly gifted and has helped a lot of couples. She works with her partner. And I'm just delighted that we can discuss her journey and how she's having such a positive impact on the world. So thank you so much for joining me today, Stephanie. We've had fun getting this in the diary, haven't we?
Yeah. It's good to be here.
Yeah. And what's really catalyzed this is Stephanie's recently published some of her story in a book. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. But I want to really start with, let's talk about what you wrote about in the book, Stephanie, because I think that is something that has really, really shaped you and was horribly traumatic. And part of me doesn't want to dive into your trauma, but I think we need to talk about trauma and we need to actually bring these things up and out. So I'd love you just to give a little bit of an outline and some of the experiences that happened, and then we'll talk and see where that takes us.
Good. I agree with you. It's super important to be able to talk about the things that feel very personal when they're happening, and we hold them in our body as obviously personal points in our own life, that the trauma means that I don't know how to grow from that quite yet. Because once I start to grow from it, it's not trauma anymore. It's an experience that I'm now digesting, and writing this story in the book was part of my commitment to myself to say, I don't want to leave this part of my life undigested. I know there's wisdom in it. And I really, this is something that is, it's taken 43 years for me to finally feel ready to digest the wisdom. And so I wrote about an experience when I was around the middle school ages of puberty, 12, 13, 14. And it was a time, it's a time in life where sexual awakening is happening, right? The hormones have kicked in, and all of a sudden you are no longer a child. You have these feelings that you have to start to deal with. And in different families and cultures, sometimes that's more received, it's a welcome thing. Yeah. And in other cultures and families, it's a very uncomfortable time, and a lot of shame can come up around it. And quiet, like just silence at a time when there's tons of questions that pop up in children.
Completely.
And so, yeah.
Yeah.
I got to review my culture and family dynamic that was more of a shame-based culture around things not being spoken about, curiosities not being openly held, and things that I was wanting to discover with openness and curiosity, there being a very limited range of, like, these would be good things to be curious about and not these. Rather than as a kid, if you're really not given the rules, the truth is you're curious about all of it, because it's a new chapter, right, of being a human being. And what ended up happening in the midst of that culture was, as we were operating with the suppression, and this was all of the kids in the growing up in this kind of suppression, is that what do you do with the things you're afraid of? What do you do with the stuff that, like, starts to scare you about yourself, about life, about if you're going to discover in your sexuality, but just in your, even sexuality becomes your self-expression, what you're interested in, your creativity, like how you might want to be different. All of that starts to come to the forefront through this sexual awakening, and all the fears of, like, oh, but clearly there's a right way to be. And what if I'm not that right way? And what if I'm made wrong? And what if I discover that I'm going to be the only one who's wrong? I mean, it's just what shame starts to fill us with, right? And so in the midst of that, there was a lot of tension. It wasn't a time of celebration. And I think this is very common. And there started to be that hiding of ourselves from being different and then wanting to put the focus on someone else for their differences. And so that's the frequency of bullying. And it became a very, it became a battleground. Instead of we were leaning in together because we were all going through the same thing and kind of being like, what are you learning? What are you learning? What are you and learning about sex and life and self-expression and becoming an individual? We weren't leaning into each other. We were pulling away and becoming each other's, you know, enemies and competitors. And so it was a very intense time. And there, I wrote about an incident where I was the target of someone else's shame and tension and fear. And we're all at that age, we were all so scared. It was easy to whip up like a wildfire of fear, mm-hmm. you know, in others. And so I got to experience rumors and several years of being the target of rumors that was the effect was it closed me down and it closed my life and opportunities and connections down in a way that children didn't know what to do with it. Adults didn't know what to do with it. It was easier to look away and not notice, not ask too many questions or to see what was going on, but just to feel helpless. And so
can you actually just say out loud what you were actually accused of?
Yeah. I was accused by another girl of being a slut. And it was slut shaming that was like different qualities of the names that had the power back mm-hmm. then were slut yeah. and whore. And it was spoken with that disgust, that, you know, repulsion of some of it was obvious and some of it was implied, like you must know what that means, you know? And truth is kids really don't know what it means.
No,
and I've actually talked to kids who are at that age now and discovered that they hear those words still being passed around. But then when I've asked them what those mean, they don't even really know what that means. You know, it's like, well, does that mean that person's having sex? It's like, oh no, they're not even holding hands. You know, like it can be something like so innocent, but there's power in those words.
So much power. I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. They get the power, even if they don't get the meaning.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it can be used to really hurt somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I could really see by talking to kids that this age now, it gave me a deeper understanding of the ignorance that was really happening rather than that somehow the harm was intentional. It was really like a very powerless period of life. And just taking up something that felt more empowering than being powerless, right? And walking around with a target on your own back.
Yeah, so this girl was trying to step into her power.
Yeah.
But she did it in a very, and we see this a lot in girls.
Yeah.
It's the playground shaming of, I'm going to exclude you so that I feel good.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do something to you. And unfortunately, we see it in all aspects of life. But we go back into your teenage years. How did that change you? How did that affect you? Because it was horrible. I know that.
The biggest impact that it had, as I recalled the story, because a lot of this, like trauma, mm-hmm. my nervous system had just said, you know, the details aren't important. And so as I was writing, I was trusting I would remember some of the details. So my memory started coming back to me. And as I was taking the journey again, what I really got to see the impact is the isolation, is that as one person believed the rumor and pulled away, and then a group pulled away, and then those kids were at my church, and so they pulled away at church, and then my parents were stressed and they didn't know what was going on and they pulled away for different reasons. And it was just this experience of isolation, of where did the community go? Where did the net that I had been taught was that came with my life? Where did it go? And the idea that I would at 12 have any clue how to handle this, but also no one noticing to say, how are you seems like something might be going on. How are you doing? And it's the breakdown of the attunement of like connection, and that really is something that shaped me in a way that I would say an intimacy specialist is like, I've become a connection specialist, you know, because I really got to experience the survival frequency of like live or die that was connected to, is there connection or is there no connection? And can a person survive all on their own?
Yeah, it's big.
Yeah.
Because we'll pretty much do anything to avoid feeling that way.
Yes. Yeah.
I believe anyway.
Yes.
And all your safe places went, didn't they? Because church should be somewhere where you feel loved and nourished. Your family, you should feel loved and nourished, even if school is a war zone.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And you lost two really important, yeah, safety nets at the most vulnerable time of growing up.
Yeah. And I was convinced in the midst of the rejection, convinced that no one would believe my innocence in it all.
Yeah.
That if I were to tell anyone, like, why didn't you tell your parents? Why didn't you tell? Pick a teacher, something, right? Like the logic of today that I can look at it back. But to tell more people was to spread the rumor more. Yeah. And was to give them an opportunity to now add one more person to the list of those who were disappointed in me, those who I had let down. And I just couldn't risk any more people being added to that list. So it became something that my suffering had to become a secret.
Wow. So in terms of, because I know that people are going to listen to this and go, wow, all this happened just from someone saying something. Because the kind of thing you're describing, you often hear from people who've survived incest or rape, having similar emotions. People go, but they're big things. Mm-hmm. You were just excluded a bit, you know, get over yourself.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, what's your problem?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've had that voice in my head too. Yeah.
Yeah. I think maybe I heard a little bit of that voice then. but it had... You might as well have been raped from the way you're talking. Mm-hmm. And I'm not devaluing that experience or anything, but the way you're talking, it literally put you into a bubble.
Yeah.
So how did you change it? If someone had been paying attention, what would they have seen in your formative years? What would they have seen change in you if you'd been the observer? Yeah. The teacher that should have noticed, quote.
My excitement for life, for example, I'm very passionate, and that passion was getting me noticed. So my friendliness, my outwardness that would take initiative, show interest in things, that loves to learn, like everything started to, you can't suppress one thing without suppressing all of it. Right. And so all of it was becoming suppressed, and it was like a flatline frequency of toggling between very anxious and then a sharp drop into too high and too low, right? In my energy spikes. And so either I was very hyper and anxious and worried and, you know, almost in a panic, overreactive, or dropping down into not hardly being able to feel anything and nothing being of interest in life. And so the attunement to me might have noticed like these sharp, you know, peaks and drops, a lack of stability and a lack of interest, and starting to be more withdrawn, not having a lot to say. I've always had plenty to say and been very verbally expressive, and was becoming, you know, just muted, and everybody was talking about me. So I didn't want to talk more and draw attention. So there were just some key characteristics of my personality that started to go away, and to the point to where, I mean, when someone's hosting a secret, in their body, they don't move their body a lot. They don't move their energy a lot. They don't move their emotions a lot, right? Because everything is geared towards keeping that secret under cloak. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And life was just busy at that time. I get it. You know, raising teenagers is difficult. Raising children with different age ranges is difficult. Being in public school where I'm in school with 300, 600 kids, like it's easy to fall through the cracks. I see it. But there was definitely a change in my personality, but also in my ability to like digest what was happening translated into, I slowly became more allergic to more food until to the point where my digestion shut down and I couldn't digest anything. And I dropped, I think probably 30 or 40 pounds at that time and became, you know, I was muscular and was in sports and I became really thin. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't eat anything until eventually I had to be hospitalized to find out like why.
Wow. And I think if that's happened now, I'd like to think that people now understand the link between the gut and emotions.
Yeah.
And science is there. I'm not sure everyone understands it. I know the science is there because I've read it. So you're in hospital. You have no weight and you can't digest food. What happened then?
They had to find out whether, you know, did she have a brain tumor? Did she have colon cancer? Did she have, you know, the major things? And so as a kid, going through a couple of days of having every invasive test done to me, and then food allergies showed up, and then realizing that my system was so inflamed, it had become allergic to everything. Mm-hmm. So at least there was a thing now to respond to, right? A thing that couldn't be ignored.
Yeah, completely.
Even though it wasn't the problem,
the thing,
you know, yeah, at least there was something to go, okay, we need to take action. We need to deal with that. And we need to help you with that.
Mm-hmm. So at least there was some positive attention mm-hmm. from that point of view. So how did you negotiate it? How did you negotiate it? I suppose is more important.
Negotiate.
Having to literally change your diet, I'm guessing.
Mm. It was a lot more isolation because now I couldn't eat the things that my peers could eat, and I couldn't have the pizza party after a basketball game, and I couldn't go to a birthday party and eat the normal food that everybody was eating. And my family didn't enjoy having to, you know, have somebody who couldn't eat the things they enjoyed. Like, it was just another frequency of being an outcast, right? So
it's like, now, like, yeah, I can see how it completely fed into it.
Yeah.
So where did that take you? It's like, I could just see that one event snowballing at this moment in time.
Well, part of the benefit, I would say, mm-hmm. to use that word, because I can see the benefit of it now, of being on my own, of being outside the norm, is that I started to ask my own questions that weren't having to be normalized by mm-hmm. that culture, right?
Yeah.
And I was curious about things that culture wasn't curious about. I was curious about how else do you eat when this particular Midwestern diet doesn't work, because it worked for everybody else. So they mm-hmm. weren't asking what else to eat, right?
Yeah,
and absolutely. That led me on a path to discover nutrition and naturopathic ways and holistic ways of, you know, eating without having to like feed my body what it needed, meaning how to listen to my body and to mm-hmm. feel what was right and what was being received well versus what I was going, my personality was saying, no, I want to do this, even though my body was clearly giving me signals that this didn't work. So that happened with food, that happened with experimenting with alcohol as a coping mechanism, and then clearly having to listen to my body going, okay, well, I'm not going to spend my life hiding from my emotions through drinking because I can't tolerate alcohol either. So my body's intolerance of things really led me to keep finding a way to connect to my emotions, to connect to what my needs are, to connect to what my body's natural way and natural rhythm was, so that I could learn me. And maybe I don't know if I'd have learned me inside that culture, but by being kicked out, I was on my own path to start to discover how does life work for me, and how does Stephanie work to be alive?
I love that, because we now know that the standard American diet, which was definitely consumed in the Midwest and is consumed in most of America still, makes people sick. Mm. And you got kicked out of it.
Yeah.
Right. It was like, your body's going, I'm not going there. I love what you just said about you weren't allowed to be normal.
Yeah.
And again, we know that normal, if you're smack in the middle of our society, you're generally sick.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's ironic that it started you on a healthier path, but I like it. I can relate to it as well.
Yeah, it did. And, you know, I had addiction in, there were models of addiction, right, in my mm-hmm. environment around me. And so I experimented with, like, maybe these are helpful ways to cope with things you can't cope with. Mm-hmm. And I feel very blessed that they didn't work for me, but it just, like, one thing after another was being taken off my plate to go, I'm not going to spend my life going down this pre-designed path. And I'm clearly not going to go into addiction, because that makes me sick. And my body becoming so sensitive mm-hmm. was really a protection mechanism, like, of the highest order for my system, to be like, I'm going to protect this essence inside of this person in a way that all that other stuff doesn't, is so clear, doesn't mm-hmm. work. It's not your path.
I love that you listened.
Yeah.
That there was some part of you that went, I have to listen, because mm-hmm. you're right. It would have been so easy just to get drunk mm-hmm. and never come back.
Right.
From that kind of experience, because it was too painful. So how, I guess that's the other thing, when you are super sensitive, and I can kind of relate to a lot of this, it is a big decision to decide to feel.
Yeah.
And to sit with things. Was that just an organic process, or was there a decision point? Do you see where I'm coming from? Because I'm always curious as to why people choose to listen and why people don't.
Yeah.
And sometimes there is a trigger, and sometimes it's just something you sneak into or drift into or choose to be in. And I'm not sure of yours, yeah.
I think that the hurt was there, but I also got introduced to a hunger that was there. And the hurt almost pushed me into the hunger, it felt like. In a way that I got to feel, if this hurts so much, what does this hungry part of me want to do about it? Like a hunger for life, a hunger to be alive. Because I took the pathway of going, okay, if I'm not important enough to be protected in life, and I just seem to be a punching bag, then maybe I should just lay down and die. So I took that path in those few years that followed, because the bullying occurred for like a 3-year cycle. And in the midst of it all, I did go to that moment where I was like, okay, is this a sign that is like, you don't belong here, get out. And so to get out would be like, okay, maybe I need to leave this body and leave this life. And I went to that moment to find out, like, is that my truth? Is that really, does that feel right? Is that what all this means? And when I touched that moment, I could feel that there was I ran into a hunger to be alive mm-hmm. that was not the, I'm taking for granted, I'm alive and I'm doing whatever everybody else does. And so again, that isolation and that being ostracized and rejected, the hurt was so big, but it also, I don't know, dug down to a core inside of me where I contacted a hunger to be alive, that from that place, I started to rebuild, my own relationship to being alive. Mm-hmm. And once I started to feel the emotions, I didn't want to numb them anymore, because that numbed the hunger. And so the hunger was connected to feeling. And I cared more about being connected to the hunger than about avoiding these emotions, which would take that hunger away from me again.
I'm getting massive shivers as you describe this.
So it was an intimacy, right? Yeah. With my hunger. That was like that first level of intimacy. And I really don't think that my culture and religion and family, as many blessings and goodness as they brought into my life, that was not the context or the vehicle that was going to introduce me to that hunger.
No. Yeah, you had to hit rock bottom to actually make that decision to go there and be exposed to it.
Yeah.
So where did that take you? Because I'm hearing nutrition, I'm hearing naturopathy, I'm hearing lots of the edges of the healing arts. Mm-hmm. What did you do when you started to have to make decisions about what you were going to do with your career? Because that comes out of our teenage years. And yours are very interesting for me.
Well, I definitely wanted to understand why people do what they do with their pain. Mm-hmm. We're not going to avoid experiencing pain, and to realize that there are things that can magnify that pain and spread it to others. And there are also ways that that pain can become a, like a surgical tool that cuts us open in order to grow and heal, mm-hmm. and that growth and healing can be spread to others too. And I became very fascinated by like, what are you doing with your pain? What am I doing with my pain? Mm-hmm. What, like, and what is the effect that it's having on the world around us? And so that led me into studying psychology, and that led me into wanting to work with people whose brains work differently, whether it be learning disabilities or wanting to understand how emotions, how does emotional intelligence develop, mm-hmm. right? Where the cognitive capacity to understand yourself is connected to the emotional capacity to feel safe and feel yourself, which then led me into understanding the nervous system, which then connected me to network spinal analysis, right? And SRI and somatorespiratory integration and the understanding of like, how do we have access to the nervous system in a way that the nervous system is an internal safety barometer that then can make the scariest things in life safe to feel. And as long as life is being lived from the mind, then there's a lot that can be judged as like too dangerous, too scary, too unfamiliar. But through the safety of the nervous system, I found my drug to be able to like open and keep opening and opening. Mm-hmm. And I would see people and work with people and help their nervous systems to open. And then they'd be like, oh, I've only ever experienced this on drugs. And I'm like, I know, because there's like, there's capacity inside of it. And so this hunger started finding my passion for how we can have control and how I could have like a positive control, mm-hmm. to influence the openness of myself. And when we close through pain and difficulty and overwhelm, then how does openness in time come back online so that that closure doesn't become like a new orientation to life where, you know, that's trauma. Where something happens and I could never come back online and digest it.
You said something really interesting there. I loved what you just said, but the thing that just went, ooh, was the word control. Mm. Because a lot of people are trying to use their minds. They're trying to control everything around them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it could be a very strict parent or OCD type symptoms, but you just said control in a way that made me want more control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's controlling your capacity to be safe, controlling your capacity to open, controlling your capacity to handle things you don't think you can control.
Yes.
Because that's healthy control. Mm-hmm. I just feel there's a little bit more to explore there because I've never heard anyone verbalize it so beautifully. Mm-hmm. But it's come from your pain. Yeah.
Yeah. And I did. I saw, okay, there's avoidance. And there's avoidance through many different mechanisms, but the avoidance of like becoming an avoidant, right? Through the emotional defense system, like, or using alcohol or drugs to create a barrier, like all of it, I started going, okay, I see the relief that people are seeking, but it also strips their control. And I want the control to be in relationship with what I'm feeling so that I can talk to myself, not abandon myself. I can create intimacy and growth out of pain instead of just devastation and remaining feeling broken and as though I have lost a part of myself instead of something that continues to feed my gratitude for everything that occurs and feed my sense of internal goodness rather than the internal badness and sin that I grew up with as a central concept. And then realizing that, oh, there's also like a central core goodness inside of us. And that whenever I mute any part of my experience, I mute my connection to that goodness. And I was like, uh-uh, nothing's going to take that away from me. That's in my control. And I want to feel that goodness as often as possible. And I want it in my control. And I don't want to give that control away to addictions and to emotional avoidance and to mentalizing my experience.
Yeah, no, it's like, I just love how you're describing it because everything is actually within us. Mm. But we can give our control to a belief that sex is sinful.
Yeah.
For example, just to be very black and white. And if we are black and white, we miss all these wonderful experiences because we limit ourselves to perfection or doom. And the bully that went for you was actually very black and white, and she managed to exclude you, which is horrible, rather than to accept. I'm kind of guessing you were probably prettier than her or something.
I think I was definitely more alive. I had an innocence inside of me that was starting to enjoy flirting, enjoy attention, boys and girls, just like becoming a social being, right? And an inner light that hadn't started questioning whether that was like a good way to be. I just felt bright.
Yes.
Yeah. And so if I look back at the things that, again, were beneficial about it, is that basically the gossip was saying she's different. And I eventually could come to the place of like, I am different.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's good.
Yeah. And that like, she's not like us. Yeah. And she's got a light inside of her and it makes you stand out. I'm like, it does. And it's like all these principles have become part of my work, but in a way that it's like that is something that makes us unique, right? And I feel like I've been drawn to the things that spiritually and psychologically and at the body level, the nervous system level, the understanding of just how unique are we? Mm-hmm. You know, we're so like each other, but there's unique purpose and there's a unique frequency of all the little moments of your life and my life that have come together that are like a snowflake, and that I'm going to imprint something into this world that I'll call wisdom that comes from my lived experience, but not if I shut down to it. Not if I decide that that wasn't a good thing that happened to me. Not if I decide that that wasn't something that human beings can grow through. And it's definitely not something I can grow through because I don't know how to face this pain. And I don't know how pain becomes anything other than something that just keeps hurting you.
Yeah.
And that's become my a passion to understand, how does pain translate? How does it go through its transformation into an awakened wisdom that's inside? That it just becomes like a life force that emanates and we touch each other in ways that we don't even know what we say and what we do, but we can open each other with that instead of close each other.
Yeah. Cause I'm hearing from your experience, pain was the spark that actually lit up the journey. Mm-hmm. It was almost like the fire you needed to step away and go, yay, I am different. Which everybody could say if they started to truly connect to their uniqueness.
Yeah.
Because you're right, we're all different and we're all part of the same.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the celebration of humanity, that everyone's uniquely different, but part of something bigger. Mm-hmm. And we're all humans, you know, we've got pretty much the same wiring and the same basic bits, haven't we?
Yeah.
But it's the spark that means that some people like you and some people don't. And some mm-hmm. people will learn from you and some people will reject you.
Exactly. And that it really is, it's safe to be like on your path, finding the people and the things that you light up and light you up. And it doesn't have to, like, other people can say, no, you're not my cup of tea. I don't need something from you, because I know that, especially now as I've opened up this part of my history to say, yeah, I feel ready for this to be on my resume too. You know, my life resume. Like these are experiences I had that have made me wise, but for a long time, I have closed them down to say, I really don't know how to find the wisdom in them. And so I'm going to just keep that in this lockbox. And this recent writing of the story was my time to finally say, this hunger inside of me said, you know what? There's gold in there. And there's like whatever I'm wanting to experience that even goes beyond how good it is now in life, the fuel source is inside that pain. It's time.
The thing I find really fascinating about you is that you've been working in the field of intimacy for a long time. So you managed to work successfully in that field. And then you've brought this extra depth of understanding. But you were doing it anyway. So it was like it pushed, I think a lot of us do, we call it, it's unconscious competence, isn't it? You were pushed away and you weren't totally you weren't totally conscious as why you had to go that way.
Right.
But you had to go that way because something bigger was saying, go that way. And this almost feels like the completion of the first circle. I don't want to say completion because you're so young. Well, you're my age, so you're really young. Yeah. And there's so much more to come. Yeah. But that's what I feel like. It's almost like a resolution to why. And by digging back, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because sometimes you can go and chew over your past and actually it re-traumatizes you.
Right.
And I think a lot of talk therapy without the body component can, and they're starting to see that, can actually re-traumatize.
Yes.
But that wasn't your experience when you went back. It was like opening the golden apple and going, whoa.
And it was really hard. Like, there was a lot to re-experience at the body level my body waking up to things that had been frozen, right? So as life force comes awake, like it can seem like chaos is happening. Mm-hmm. But I understand enough about everything that relates to this that I could hold myself in a place of knowing that this was the disturbance that is part of awakening instead of the disturbance that was like just a recycling of pain.
Yeah.
And the piece for me, yes, the body was also making... I was saying making sure, but so I did make sure, but it was time to do it because I have community. I have the components that were missing, so to say, back then. I have the thing that blew up, right? Which was my net. I have that net now, you know, I have a relationship in my life, a core relationship. I have some key friends. I have people who I have a connection to my family now. Like I was realizing like, it's not just that now things are different, but things are different so that I can host and hold that young part of me who is still frozen in time, believing she has none of that at her back, and bring her up to date and join me in this life where I have what I need. Like I have who I need and what I need, and I am held, and I'm not that young girl who is excluded anymore. And I took my own path to find it.
You bring up another topic that I think we have a lot of commonality on, is that healing doesn't happen in isolation.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And we need healers. We need friends. We need people who love us. And family can be biological or they can just be family.
Yes.
And it's like you've built, I don't think anyone, I hear that all the time in my practice. What can I do on my own? People want to do all their healing on their own.
Yeah. And it's not, especially what we're talking about, these these breakdowns of our bonding world, you know, that actually inform our sense of solidness, security, worth inside, happens inside of a bonding field. And when injury happens inside that attachment, connection, bonding field, you don't go in isolation and heal it by yourself. It's done, even if it's held within a caring relationship with a healer.
Yeah.
Like that can be just one member of an external community that becomes the building block that's needed. But that healing, that self, that self-love comes from a value that's witnessed by another. At least that's how I would say it. And that witness has to happen. And then that becomes a seed that can blossom now into like, I have a garden of self-love inside me.
Yeah. And consequently around you.
Yeah.
And around you becomes within. It's like, we're not separate, are we? Yeah. I think sometimes you'd love to think you are. I can just sort myself out, but actually.
No.
And that's the child speaking, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's the in attachment psychology, that's that component that reminds us all that like we're born as a species still so dependent. We're outside the body, but we're still so dependent on our environment and the care that would arrive in that environment to ensure that the independence state can get there. And so everything that happened between that dependent and independent state is the how we can trust interdependence. Right? That it's safe to trust others. And that does get injured as an attachment wound. But the nervous system is flexible. It can be repatterned back into secure and safe attachment with other human beings' care.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Because I'm trying to think how long since we met, and it's probably not that long, 3 or 4 years. And you were blooming then, and now you're even more radiant, which I think is really fantastic. So if we come more into the present, where did all of this take you? And how's it showing up in your life now? Because I introduced you with like two words, intimacy coach, which doesn't say very much. That can mean a lot of things. But where did this take you professionally and personally, I suppose?
Understanding all aspects, like my craving to understand all aspects of intimacy. So self-intimacy, I've been studying that for years to live it, you know, live where is there, how do I create, develop, nurture, secure attachment within so that there's actually an internal mother, there's an internal guardian, protector, like a council of consultants, right? A council I can go to that is in my internal world that creates, not I can do it all myself, but that there is not the frailty of always depending on it coming from others so that I know it can be provided, but not in exclusion. I still need others, right? And because that's the relational intimacy. Right. And then understanding that, how does that happen between friends, parents and children as they become more equals in life and adults? How does that happen in family units? And then how does that extend to community and secure attachment and community and intimacy? And so it's not just sexual intimacy. It's just every component that makes us feel safe to be close and bonded with others. And I've worked with women, and I wanted to understand like the creature, you know, of the woman's heart and nervous system and how that intimacy works for her within herself, because definitely grew up in a culture and see so much culturally not being passed on for women to understand how self-intimacy develops, how they become of value to themselves in a way that they know absolutely that's no longer something that gets questioned in their life. That there's an immune system, almost like a psychic emotional immune system that develops that carries that like internal protection for them to not take on things that don't speak truth about who they are. And then to work with couples and really understand the seed that they are for growing the family, which then becomes the community. And while so much parenting efforts get put on the parent to the child, also seeing how it's the love bubble that is between the two caretakers, no matter what sexual orientation they are, it's just whoever the caretakers are. And right now they could be a group, but I'll say two, caring for the child is what imprints that child's nervous system with safe attachment, secure attachment, more than how they relate to the child even. And so what is that strengthening of that seed between the core of a family that then blossoms out into community? So I just have been feeling like intimacy in every possible way, in every way where it can, goodness can be reinfused back into it.
I'm kind of hearing it's never too late.
No, it's not. My parents, for example, are in their 70s, and there is new intimacy blossoming in them, toward each other, in themselves, with life. And it can happen at any time, as long as we're still alive. We're capable of learning something new and feeling something new in terms of rich and deep and connection that has me go, I feel intimate with life right now. I feel intimate enough to trust life, to trust myself, to trust you, to trust someone I haven't met yet.
Yeah. Not many people will say that.
No.
And it's, which I find really sad, but I also feel really hopeful.
Yeah.
I think two extremes, but
yeah. I think that people they settle, right? That's what it's what we do is we can settle to the level of loss that's in our life that we don't know how to heal. And then we forget, don't know that something more is possible. I've experienced it myself. It's too easy to become defeated and to drop into that inertia that is just like, this is the low point, I'll settle here, rather than, again, the uprising of that hunger inside that says, are you kidding me? There's got to be more than this.
Completely.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess that comes at waves in different times in someone's life.
Yeah.
And the opportunity. Often when you go, they call it the dark night of the soul, don't they, in some spiritual circles. When you hit the absolute rock bottom, you have two choices, leave or reconnect and come up. Yeah, but there's many versions of that as well, I'm sure, for a lot of people.
Yeah, I would say, though, as we feel ourselves settle into a kind of maybe a functional level of depression, right? Like a depressed life force.
Yeah.
Getting yourself around someone who's more alive than you is a great way to help you remember what you're convincing yourself you don't need anymore. Because the truth is, feeling good feels really good. Absolutely. And even a little bit more good, you know? So in that case, I would say, get yourself around even a supportive community, or hire a coach, or get a good chiropractor, or that it reminds you what life force is still inside you and that there's goodness to orient to. It's all a practice of orientation. And loss and tragedy that hasn't healed inside of us can shift our orientation to looking for the impending doom and the threat. And yet that's just a nervous system that's, you know, in not a thriving state. Yeah, different to how do I start orienting to goodness again?
Stephanie, I love all the words of wisdom you have been sharing today. You really resonate with me. It's been a complete pleasure. But anybody listening who would like to find out more about you or your work or buy your book, where do they find you online?
I have a place of stephaniefabella.com, and also about our intimacy work that I do with my husband, Dan, is it allaboutintimacy.com.
I will make sure both of those are in the show notes. And I know that people are going to be fascinated by you, because this has been a wonderful conversation, and it's been a delight to re-engage.
Nice.
Thank you so much.
I really hope you're enjoying Unmasking the Feminine as much as I am. I'd love it if you could share this with friends, family, anyone you think who may be inspired by these amazing women. And if you love it, leave me a review, because that helps me reach other people. I've also got a Facebook community, and if you want to sign up on that, click below in the notes. Thank you so much for being part of my journey.